Awesome. Okay, so the next line says to introduce our speaker, and I have known our speaker for as long as I've been sober, but for the life of me, I could not come up with anything to describe our speaker, so I chickened out and asked Anthony to do it, so come on, Anthony.
Hey guys, my name is Anthony. I'm an alcoholic, and tonight's speaker, Tom, is my grand sponsor, but I'm very privileged. I get to spend a lot of time around Tom. When I first came into the program, I first started to meet Tom. I thought he was one of those old timers with that zen-like serenity. You know, I thought he was about ready to levitate. But like I said, I get to spend a lot of time with him, and especially to hear his wife tell it, he's no saint. So, you know, what I do notice is that when the crazy under the surface, because there's no cure for the kind of crazy that we have, but when I see it flash for an instant, he's so quick to be able to pull up the tools of the program and get himself back on track. And, you know, I think that, you know, he teaches me a lot of lessons, but, you know, that's probably the most valuable one. So with that, I'll give you Tom.
I used to try to aspire to be the kind of person my pup dog thinks I am, but now I want to aspire to be the kind of guy that Anthony thinks I am. That's great. I made an outline of my talk. It's been a long time since I told my story, so when I told my wife that I was going to be telling my story, I said, I'm going to make an outline. She said, well, you better go over it with me. She says, you'll be putting people to sleep. And so, she is an Al-Anon. My name is Tom Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm from out west, and so I have a tendency to talk fast. And I know here in the South, people do things slower, so if y'all will listen a little bit faster, I'll talk a little bit slower, and I think we'll be able to get on the path here, so you'll be able to get my story out here. One of the biggest misquotes that anybody makes that tells their story is they say, I'm up here to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. That is not what it says in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've read. It always says, our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, what we are like now. And you might think, oh, that's just trivial, that's just a little thing. But think about, what if the first step says, it admitted it was powerless over alcohol and its life had become unmanageable. See, you gotta stick with the real, with the we, because that makes us talk about ourselves. I could talk about it all night long. I could stand up here and talk about war stories and all this other stuff, and everybody be comparing, wow, I wrecked more cars than he did, or I beat up more people than she did. You know, it's not about the war stories and like that. So I gotta stay with what the big book actually says, and that's one of the things that I like to do. I grew up in Southern California, and it was pretty wild. We were, I lived in Northern California some, but I'm the third of seven kids. And all three of my brothers were all 1 year apart from each other. So we were trouble in school. We were trouble in a lot of places. So it was wild. We moved 23 times in 21 years. So it was constantly. One time, we moved next door. We handed the sofa over the fence, you know. It's just crazy stuff like that. My dad worked at he was a horse trainer. So he worked at the racetracks. And, of course, it was Hollywood Park, Del Mar, and Santa Anita. And those were the three Southern California tracks. And so it was nothing. We all had to learn how to rub horses, how to walk hots, how to do the things on the racetrack. We had to learn how to do all that. But one of the childhood memories that I have is I was 5 years old, and there was this big commotion in the kitchen, and I came running out of my bedroom, and I look, and there's this huge pile of money on the kitchen table. Dad had won the races. He had won something, and he had just money, just pop. Brand new car in the driveway. He had bought us all new bicycles and scooters. I had a scooter, and my little brother had a tricycle and two bicycles with the guide wheels on for my next two older brothers. And so it was just like, wow, this is the greatest. This is the greatest. It wasn't maybe a month later, I went to Mom and said, Mom, you can sell my scooter so we can have some money, because we were broke. My dad was addicted to gambling, he was addicted to alcohol, and Mom was addicted to him. And that's the way the lives went. We were just constantly in chaos. We would walk the streets up and down looking for pop bottles in order to buy flour and baking powder so Mom could make bread, because Dad gambled away the money. It was gone. That was it. And a lot of the times that we moved because it was either moved or the sheriff was coming, one or the other. You know, we didn't pay the rent, so we were getting kicked out, or we had to beat because we knew the next day the landlord was going to be there, so we had to put everything into a U-Haul and haul booty before we got into a lot of trouble with that. So it was just chaos. It was chaos. And every school that I went to, I was the odd man out. I always felt weird because there were kids that actually like grew up together, and they spent like all these years together, and they knew each other, and then there was me. And I was always hiding in the back corner somewhere. So not only did I feel different, I was different because I didn't fit in. I just didn't fit in. So it was weird. It was weird. I learned to be a recluse. I just kind of like, you know, got small, didn't say anything, didn't do anything. And just that's the way I lived my life. I do recall when that changed. It was when I drank alcohol seriously for the first time. I'd sip a little beer here and there and just have, you know, a little sip of whiskey or something like that. But when I had that first drink, it was nasty. It burned, and I coughed and hacked, and about 2 minutes later I thought, well, maybe I should try that again. And I did. It didn't quite burn as hard or as much. You know, it went down a little smoother. So after about the third or fourth drink, my whole attitude and outlook upon life changed. I found a new freedom and a new happiness. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity is gone. It disappeared. Fear of people and economic insecurity, it's gone. It left me. That was nothing at all. So from that moment on, I realized that booze was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And from then on, it became my higher power. I let it control everything in my life. Didn't realize it was happening instantly. It took a lot of time. Over the years, it slowly started going where I would just drink a little bit, and then I couldn't not drink. And then it was just to the point where toward the end, I was drinking, a quart barely lasted a day of vodka. It was pure vodka, and a quart didn't last a day. So it was pretty intense. I was miserable. I was shaken. I was losing everything in my life. Patty wanted to leave. My wife wanted to leave me. My brother was sick and tired. I was working for him, and he was sick and tired of me. So when we left California, moved to Louisville, and I was there for about 10 years, and then one of my customers said, hey, we're buying a home down in Sarasota, Florida. Why don't you come down and I'm a remodeling contractor. So I went down there. I thought, oh, good, maybe I won't drink as much if I go to Florida. That didn't work. So I moved down to Sarasota and was there for 10 years where I met my current wife. And She came over to the house that I was doing the remodeling on. She was at the Ringling School of Art and Interior Design, so she was working for an interior designer, and came over to measure draperies or whatever, and I hit on her immediately. I was like, wow, she's cute, you know. So she said yes, and then turned around, called me, and said, no, I'm engaged, you know, we can't do this. But anyway, a couple years later, we got together and did that. So after we were, so we lived in Sarasota, got married, and then, oh, you know what I left out was when I got, when I moved to Louisville, I lived there during that 10-year period. I got drafted and spent my whole time over in Germany. So I got, that was military, and I knew how to sneak, man. I got into their cheap booze. I got, just like I was an officer, I got figured out how to fake a signature. So I got all my booze really cheap from the Class 6 store. And my locker looked like a liquor store. I mean, it was full, because the whole time there I was drunk and participated in other types of things too, but that was it. So I got back out of the Army and went back to Louisville and got married to a young lady for about 2 years, 2.5 years, and out of that 2.5 year period, we were together about 10 months. The rest of the time she was in the Kentucky State Mental Institution. She had mental problems. I didn't realize that at the time. We had dated years before when I first moved to Louisville, but I didn't realize, and she was one sick little girl. It was one of the hardest things for me to do at that time in my life, was to commit her to that insane asylum, because it was one of those weird ones, man, out in the middle of nowhere. It was scary. I did that, and I dealt with that whole thing with smoking pot and drinking booze. That's how I handle situations during that time of my life. That's how I took care of things, is I used booze. I remember Dad, you know, whenever there was a problem, he'd say, man, if I could just get me a half pint, everything will be fine. And it seemed like it was. He'd get some booze in him and everything would be smooth. I learned, well, booze is the answer, and I did that. You know, a flat tire, I can't fix a flat tire until I get some booze, man. This, you know, this is just terrible. This can't do it. It just they don't go together. So anyway, that was flashback, but there it is. So then when we moved from Sarasota to Tampa for about, I don't know, maybe a year or something like that, and then my brother Bill was here in Atlanta, and he wanted me to help him do a remodel job here. So I was thinking, well, maybe if I move to Atlanta, that'll help, you know. So I took off, left Patty stranded down in Florida. She was down there at the house, and I came up here, and I thought it was going to be for a few weeks, but, you know, I thought, nah, I like it here. So I just called Pat. I said, okay. I said, I'm going to stay up here. And she's all like, yeah, thanks, you know. But so we wound up renting out the house. We wound up selling the house. And then she came up here to Atlanta. And I had rented a townhouse over in Sandy Springs. And we stayed there for a year and then found the place that we live in right now. And that's where we moved to. It's a condo right here, 5 minutes from here. 5 minutes from here. And that is a really good part of my story, because at the very end of my drinking career, what happened? I didn't tell you because I was not conscious, but I had drank so much alcohol that it couldn't stay down. I mean, I was so alcohol poisoned. I weighed like 128 pounds, shaking like a leaf. I was yellow, my feet were gray, I was just like, I was near death, that's all there was to it. And so the last day, one of my brothers that lives in Texas happened to be visiting and was supposed to work with me downstairs in the shop where I've got a wood shop. And so I couldn't get up off the sofa because I was just so hung over and so miserable. And so he says, all right, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I'm not going to be around here. I'm not going to stay around here and watch this. I go, no, man, let's go to work. So we go down the stairs, boom, that's all I remember. And what had happened was I'd had a grand mal seizure and rigidly went stiff, fell back, busted my head open, and started bleeding out on the shop floor. Fortunately, David was there to stuff rags against my head, call 911, put the cats up so that they wouldn't escape from inside. He just did all this stuff automatically. He just did it like that. So from the moment of walking down the stairs, the next thing I did is I woke up and I was strapped to a board in a hospital room. And I was like, what happened? What's going on here? And so I was told what had happened, that I'd had a seizure and that this, you know, this was the thing. This is what was going on. So I was like, okay, well, you know, 5 days I was next door here at Smyrna Hospital, IV detox. I mean, I was sick. I remember coming to a number of times during those days and just knowing I was so sick. And they kept me from seizing again, but man, it was terrible. So I used to wake up inside of dreams. Okay, I'd have a dream, and then while I was dreaming, I thought I was in reality. And so it was like, you know, it's so real until I actually did wake up. And then I look back and think, wow, that was weird. And it happened for years. I got redrafted. That was the worst part. It's like I'd wake up and I'd be in my dream and I'd be like, oh no, they drafted me again. I got my DD-214, man. You can't draft me. Look, I was a company clerk in the Army, so I knew all the rigmarole stuff. So I, you know, and I do that and then like that. So anyway, that had happened over and over and over. That happened just dozens and dozens of times that I would wake up in a dream. Well, I thought that was happening at the hospital because I woke up in the hospital one about the third or fourth night. And I looked around and I saw all these tubes and stuff in me and I thought, oh, it's one of those dreams. Oh, that's cool, you know. So I get up, you know, and I'm doing the thing and I come out and I'm walking down the hallway and this nurse screams and she runs over to me. She goes, what are you doing, Mr. Scott? What are you doing? I went, oh, I'm in a dream. You're in a dream too. Oh. She didn't think it was funny. She turned around, she goes, look at that. Does that look like a dream? There's a trail of blood leading back into my room. I was like, oh. Yeah, this is real. This is real. So she led me back to my room, hooked me back up, and then after about the fifth or sixth day, Patty had fortunately come next door here and got me a room, so to speak, got a bed. She had the paperwork filled out, and she tricked me into doing an assessment sort of thing. You know, and here I was. I mean, I'm still... Six days without a drink, shaking like a leaf, scrawny as a thing, still looking funny and yellow, stitches in my head, you know, can't remember stuff because I had a concussion, bleeding on the brain, and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, should I really go into treatment and do this? You know, that's the insanity of the disease. Right there's the insanity. So I came into Ridgefield. And that was the 6th of February, 1990. So I've been sober 28 years. And I've been here for 28 years, almost every Friday night for 28 years I've been coming here. I want to thank Sarah for asking me. This is the first time that anybody's asked me to tell my story in that 28 years. So thank you, Sarah. I've told it in other places out around Atlanta, but this is the first time here. So it's an honor to get to do that. So from there, I got introduced to Richard Morgan was my case manager. He's an amazing guy. He was wonderful. He's not with us anymore, but he was really good. And his point blank, in your face truth about the way I was acting and the way that I thought about things and the way that I had perceived life just was a complete opposite. I'd never met anybody who would confront me like that. I never met anybody who would tell me the truth about that, about me and about how I was. So he was instrumental in helping get me on the road to recovery. Rochelle Moore is another one, a lady here. She was amazing. And when I got ready to check out the day that... I think now people go through Sam, but back then there were three different people that you would go and check out. Somebody left this coffee and it's green. But Rochelle, when I was getting ready to check out, she said, you have a plan, you know, you're going to have a plan for what you're going to do. I said, oh yeah, okay, well. Such a night, I go and play pool. Such a night. She said, I don't think so. She said, no, you're not going to be doing any of that stuff. You're going to be doing, you know, we're going to come up with a whole new plan. So, and one of the plans included going to a meeting every night. And I remember the look on Rochelle's face when I said, "But Rochelle, you don't understand. I'm a very busy man." And the look on her face, looking at me with all of my condition like that, I could see how that would have been, what a ridiculous thing to say. But anyway, I did anyway. So I got out and I made an agreement with my wife. We had a pact, an agreement of what to do if I started showing signs of relapse, because Patty was on board with helping me stay sober as much as possible. So instead of saying, "Well, you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do this," and making it a thing of dictating, we got together and said, "You know, what if you start acting like this? What do you want me to do?" You know, I said, "Well, call one of my brothers, or call Sam, or call, you know, like that." And so we went down the list of these different things, and we posted it on the refrigerator. So there wasn't any of this sneaking around, hiding, thinking, "Well, maybe I don't have to go to a meeting. Maybe I don't have to." We made an agreement together. We posted on the refrigerator, and it stayed up there the whole time. So I became responsible for my actions, which I was never. I was always blaming people and things and other stuff. I was never took responsibility for my actions. So that was one of the first things that we did. The other thing was, I had to get in this van, and when I was on Cottage, and they actually took me to a meeting. It was like the stupid meeting over here at St. Jude's Church over on Windy Hill Road. It's my home group. I've been going there for 28 years. But the first night, I was like rebellious. I don't want to go to that stupid AA meeting. I don't need to go to that stupid AA meeting. But I did. I got in the truck and I went over there, and I just, you know, figured, well, I'll just show up once, you know. And then, of course, the following week, I got put in a van again and took it, you know, second time. And by then, I thought, well, I saw that guy. Maybe, you know, that's it. So I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through Ridgeview Institute. One of the things that I learned from Alcoholics Anonymous at my home group was everybody there wanted to help each other and wanted nothing for it. And that concept, which is, of course, Bill and Bob's original concept, was just incomprehensible to me. Everybody had an angle. I just knew everybody wanted something for something, you know. I just couldn't conceive of people wanting to help for no reason, just because they wanted to help. They wanted to help keep me sober, and they said doing that, it would help keep them sober. I'm like, yeah, whatever, but yeah. So it was just one of those times that I said, I'm going to trust this. I know everything I've done in my life has failed. I've got to trust something else. So I'm going to ask these guys what they did and how they stayed sober. How did you guys do this stuff? And they started telling me how they did it. They told me that they were working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'd seen the writing on the wall. I knew that was there, but then I thought, okay, well, I can do that. And they said, you should do that with a sponsor. And I was like, okay. I'm thinking Coca-Cola, Home Depot, you know. Who could I get? You know, that's where my mind went. And then they explained to me what a sponsor really was. And I was definitely anti-Christian at the time, too. I was anti-established just about everything. I was anti, that was it. But I didn't hesitate to voice my anti-Christian attitude either at meetings. And the guys that were so patient with me, they were so gentle, they just didn't jump in my stuff, but they knew that was it. But and there was this one guy, big guy, and he would say some of the coolest stuff. I mean, he said stuff that was just like, whoa, I want to think like that, you know. I want to be like that guy. And so after a few weeks of listening to him, I went over and asked him. I said, "Hey, Chuck, would you be my sponsor?" And he said, "I don't know. I'll ask my sponsor." So he did. He checked with his sponsor, and his sponsor said, "Sure, go ahead and do that." So he said, "Okay, Tom." He says, "Come over to my house, and, you know, tomorrow, and we'll talk about, you know, a game plan, what we're going to do to help you work through the steps." So I go over, and he lives real close, right over on Cooper Lake. And so I just go around the corner from where we live, and I go over there. And I look around, and there's crosses on the wall. And I'm like, what the hell, Chuck, what do you do? He goes, I'm the United Methodist minister up here at Tillman United Methodist Church. I went, sense of humor. That was the end of my anti-Christian attitude. That was it. It was so blatant. There it was. So I was like, okay, all right. So Chuck and I had a lot of good years together. He's not living, he's still living, but he's not around here anymore. But we did things together. We played tennis, and we went to a lot of different meetings together. We went hiking together. And most importantly was we worked the steps together. I didn't have to try and figure out how to work the steps. I didn't have to figure out how to try to do AA either. The guys in my home group said, Tom, look, this road that you're getting ready to get on, this road to recovery that you're getting ready to travel is not going to be just all smooth and covered with rose petals. It's got rocks and holes, and it's got sticks and things and like that. He says, but the deal is we've already been down that path. We can help you go around those places. We can help show you where the rocks are so you don't have to fall in the hole. You don't have to stumble. You don't have to do these things. We're here to help you. This is one of the things that we're going to do. And I thought that was amazing, because that's the way we do it today. That's how we do it. When we help another person, a newcomer especially, come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we start working the steps with them, that's what we're doing. We think we've already been here. We know how to help that person stay sober without them having to go through all the trials and tribulations that perhaps they would if they tried to do this thing all by themselves. So we don't have to do it by ourselves. We don't have to do anything by ourselves ever again. We just don't have to because of that. So the one of the most important steps that I found is the 11th step, with the prayer and the meditation. And I know that is like way over the head of anybody who is new to the program, because it took me years before I got to that point to be able to do that. However, practicing is the magic word. It says practice the principles. Practice this step. Practice doing this stuff. And that's what I do, is I practice. One of the things that it says that we get out of that step is each of the things, the prayer is really important, the meditation is really important, but combined, to put the two together, it gives us an unshakable foundation for life. Why not? Give me that, you know? So I started incorporating the prayer and the meditation, and I have been able to build an unshakable foundation for life. It's one of those things that just happens because we do the things that we're told. I didn't fight that much. I think Patty might have a different opinion on that, but I don't think I fought that much about the things. I think I was pretty well beaten down, and I was like, whatever you guys want me to do, I'll do it. And one of the In chapter 9, the chapter to wives, it says, it talks about us being, it doesn't say crazy. It just says that the way we used to be is not going to work anymore. And it says what we were is going to be replaced by a great sense of purpose. And when that happens to each of us, when we discover what our great sense of purpose is, it's life-changing. It's life-changing. And each person will discover it at their own time, in their own place. They'll say, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is what I'm supposed to be doing here. You will have that great sense of purpose. Don't know when it's going to happen, but it does happen. I've spoken with a lot of different alcoholics over the years, and they say, yep, happened to me. Or some say, nope, hadn't happened to me yet. You know, that's fine. There's no time limit. It doesn't matter that you have to do that. Another thing, it says in the foreword of the third edition of the big, I'm not a big book thumper, in case y'all are wondering. I just looked this stuff up so I'd sound smart. Okay, it's not like I read the Big Book every day. It's just once in a while something really cool will come to me, and I'm like, I got to remember that. But it says, what's the book Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, what's so it's a book. So what's it do? It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That is the main purpose of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you want to know precisely how it works, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the one that does it. We can do it by sharing. We can do it by going to meetings. We can do it by talking with sponsors. We can do it by, but it takes all of that stuff together, including the reading of the Big Book, in order to learn collectively how we go about doing that. So, and then it was the thing of I use my home group as my higher power. I use that as my higher power to replace the dependence on alcohol. I went over the dependence of a home group, which worked because these guys were great, and I didn't throw up on them or anything. You know, I didn't react to them the way I reacted to alcohol. You know, alcohol is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Vodka, it's fine as long as it just sits up there on the shelf. If I try to communicate with it, it doesn't work. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that we don't have a relationship. I was able to have a relationship with the guys in my home group because they're just a wonderful bunch of people. Over time, we went to Northern California, out there in a ranch, way up in Northern California, to do some other kind of emotional work, I guess you'd call it. And we went back, both my wife and I went two separate times, and then collectively went back to a spiritual renewal workshop. And I thought, this is going to be cool, you know, because I was still searching for a replacement for my home group spirituality. You know, they're great, but, you know, I was evolving. Everybody's spiritual evolution is gonna happen. So for me, it was like, okay. Oh, and I had made the mistake of trying really hard with my sponsor to make a higher power, to get something. You know, I'm like, I just need, and he said, you're trying too hard. He says, don't make it happen. Let it happen. So just open up to things that you're closed to, and maybe that higher power will come to you. And I was like, okay. So when we went back for the spiritual renewal workshop up in Northern California, one of the spiritual things that was offered was a Native American sweat lodge ceremony. So I said, I think I'll try that. You know, there were all kinds of different types of things, but I did. And so as soon as, it's my very first time, as soon as I crawled inside that little dark place and got in there, that was it. I felt a connection. To this day, that connection is still with me. I just know that is my connection with a higher power. Everybody's going to find their own, and they're going to find it in their own time, and they're going to find the one that fits with them. That one particularly was the one that fit for me, and it's just I still do that. That is my spiritual path. Native American spirituality, Mother Earth spirituality, that is what fits me. That is what I do on a daily basis. That is what I do regularly. That's what is one of the things that I do that helps keep me sober, and I get to share that with other people too. I've had friends over in my house, and we've prayed and done things over at the house, and it has worked very well for me. And I got ready to leave the Pocket Ranch, and we were in a Jeep, and we had a Jeep driver, and the guy who was conducting the ceremony, this great big dude, his name is Thunder Bear, huge, big old burly guy. And then Patty and I were in the back seat, and we're driving down this thing. It takes about 20 minutes to get down to the main road, and he's driving along. All of a sudden, he turns around, and he goes, Tom, he says, I'm supposed to teach you. I'm supposed to teach you the way of the sacred pipe. I was like, okay, now what do I do? So he says, come to my place. So he's got a little cabin up in South Carolina. So for the next year, every weekend, almost every weekend, I went up and studied and learned how to do ceremony in a proper way so that when I do it, I can teach people in a proper way to do that. So it's not only something that I picked up because I felt it, it was something that was also presented to me in a way that I was supposed to stay on that path, like a mandate rather than just just a suggestion, is the way I look at it. And it's just been great. It has just been really, really helpful for me. One of the things that we need to, the Alumni Association, that's one of the other things that helps keep me sober, is the alumni. I came to three of the aftercares. They had three at the time during the week. I'd come to every one of the aftercares that was here because it was one of those magic things. One of my first miracles happened was that I got sober. I got released from Ridgeview the day my insurance ran out. It was one of those things that you just like, how did that happen? They let me go. And so they let me do that. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to owe them a whole lot of money for a very long period of time. So I started taking advantage of it and coming to every one of their aftercares. I came to all the alumni meetings. I came to all that. And I realized that is just stuff that helped me stay sober. It's just stuff that helped keep me on my sober path. Every Saturday night, right down the hill there is a meeting called Relationships in Recovery. It's been there for about 25 years. So anybody who wants to come and discuss the relationship and the damage that was done to that relationship because of the disease of alcoholism too. We may not realize it, but there's a lot, we do more damage than just to ourselves. When we're in a relationship, we damage the relationship. So that's a place that we can come and actually discuss how to help repair the relationship that was damaged by the disease of alcoholism. It's at 7:30. So I should write. I usually write it on the bulletin board. Some of you have seen me do that. 7:30, Pro North, Saturday. Yeah, so you're welcome to come and do that. But that's something else that helped keep me sober. Something else that helped keep me on the right path. The other thing I have to remember too is, when I start, I have to keep my opinion to myself. And it's one of the hardest things to do, especially when I hear somebody else spouting off their attitude or their opinion or something like, let me set you straight here. You know, I want to make sure that I impose my help on them. What I have to remember is I'm an ambassador to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm out there in some grocery store somewhere, or if I'm in some just gathering, and I'm out there and I'm bad-mouthing some college or some sports team or some political thing, and I'm doing, being myself, and then I'm in an AA meeting, one of those people might walk in and see me and sit there and think, oh, that's that ass, like, that, you know, was saying all those bad things about my college, you know, or something like that. So I have to remember, I am an ambassador. So I have to, I'm entitled to my opinion. I just keep it to myself. And that way I don't alienate anybody who may wind up crawling into these doors one day and being able to say, wow, you know, these guys were open and honest. They were doing this. They weren't in there opinionated and saying, you can't come in here because you got the wrong color shirt or you drive the wrong kind of car or something. None of that. So I have to remember to do that. One of the things that Sam says, I'm sure other people have said it, but one of the things that he has expressed the first time I heard it was from Sam, and it says, what other people think of me is none of my business. And that is true if I'm working a good, honest program. If I'm doing the next right thing. If I have worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have gone through the fourth and fifth step, which really gets us to know ourselves, that's how I discovered who I was, by getting in there and digging in and finding out the truth about me. Because I used to be a chameleon, you know, whatever I needed to do to fit in, I would do that. Because I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what the truth was about me. I just didn't know. So now I do know that. So if somebody's going to think to me, oh, Tom Scott, man, he's one of those gurus. He's in he's in AA, and he's just all this cool dude and all that stuff. You know, or somebody might say, oh, that Tom Scott, he just quotes shit. You know, he make stuff up. You know, he's just a piece of crap. Neither one of those are the truth. So I give them the same amount of energy because neither one of them's the truth. How would I know unless I knew what the truth was? And that was by working the steps, I find out who I really am. And so people can say those things about me and it doesn't matter because, you know, I know the truth. If, however, I ignore somebody who is trying to save my life because I'm off the beam, I'm angry or I'm discontented or I'm doing something that's really wrong, and one of my guys in the home group said, hey, Tom, you know, what's wrong with you? What's going on here? And I'm like, oh, what you think of me is none of my business. No, that's not. That's the time to stop and think. Why? Is there something going on? You know, am I like ragefully blinded by some attitude that I've got, a resentment or something? And so that's when I have to, that's when it matters what other people say, because they could save my life by listening to them. So what I do is I pay attention and I'll listen to it and then I will, you know, think, wow, is this really something? Talk to my sponsor about it. Talk to somebody else who knows me and say, hey, so-and-so just said, you know, that I was, am I doing that? Or is it, you know, and so it's always good to check it out rather than just abandoning, you know, nah, whatever, you know, I'm just doing that stuff. Let me see, what am I down to? What am I like now? Well, I found peace. That's one of the things that I always look for with pot and hash and acid and drugs and of all kinds and whatever. I was looking for peace. Never found it. Today, I comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. It's come to me because of working this recovery program, because of doing the things that I've have been asked to do and doing the things that I've been told to do without arguing. That is one of the greatest gifts, I think, is to know that I have found that. Y'all like this because it's going to be a short story because of you got smoke a little. I used to smoke. I don't smoke anymore. But one of the things that there's a Mohican word. It's natushneya, and natushneya means the connectedness of all things. It's how we are interconnected to all things. And I think about that when I look at the audience and I see this common denominator that we all have. We are all in recovery. We are all trying to become better people. We're trying to gain that lost human potential that we once had. And that connectedness, that natushnia that we have, that we share, is one of those things that I just absolutely love. And I appreciate you all being here to listen to my story. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. You know, I was going to lead with the talking about the Native American stuff as your spirituality. I was like, well, I'm pretty sure that's what his spirituality is geared around, but what if I'm wrong? So and it was, then what will people think? So, you know, I still worry about what other people think.